Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Helena Basil-Morozo, a cultural philosopher, a writer and lecturer in media and communication at Glasgow Caledonian University. She's interested in ways in which we interact with our society and particularly how our identities are shaped by our environment. Her books include Tim Burton, The Monster and the Crowd, The Trickster in Contemporary Film, and her latest book, which is co-written with Luke Hockley and comes out in December, is entitled Jungian Film Studies, The Essential Guide. And this is going to be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Helena. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you. Hello, Barry.
Okay, well, could you begin, Helena, by telling us maybe a bit about yourself and how you became interested in this field of work and maybe Jung in general?
I first became interested in Jung as a PhD student, which was 15, 16 years ago when I was writing a dissertation about John Fowles, who is out of fashion, unfortunately, at the moment. But his novels are quite archetypal. Mm-hmm. And he was himself interested in Jung and influenced by Jung. So I had to use Jung. Yeah. Because many of his narratives are actually structured in a very Jungian way. And then I realized that I would love to do this with film as well, particularly because Christopher Vogler's book was becoming more and more popular. And this is a book of a Hollywood doctor, kind of script writing doctor who uses Jung to write perfect Hollywood narratives that would sell. And so I realized that Jung is extremely applicable to film studies and to filmmaking and to script writing as well. And so since then, I've been writing books about Jung and film studies, or application of Jungian theory to film studies.
Okay, well let's just dive straight in then. So to get a general understanding of film studies, how has it generally been organized up to now?
It's quite, I'd say Jungian film studies became prominent in the 21st century because Jungian scholars before the 21st century weren't really interested in film studies. Again, that's Vogler's book that made people more interested in applying Jung to film studies. I'd say there are two schools in general, two types of Jungian film scholars. One is myself and Terry Waddell and Katrina Miller, for instance, who write about more about archetypes in narratives, because we try to apply. I teach creative writing students. I teach screenwriting students. So I need Jung to actually teach them how to use archetypes and the individuation process in narratives. And the second school is more interested in how meaning is created in the audience, how the audience perceives narratives and how they draw meaning out of the narratives. The Jungian phenomenological school, so to say, that's Luke Hockley, that's Greg Singh, for instance, they're more interested in the meaning-making process. And all, obviously there's Chris Hawke, who is also a filmmaker, and he's interested in both how narratives influence people, how people make meaning out of these narratives, how they relate to the narratives, and they're also he's also interested in the structure of the narratives and how you as a filmmaker or a scriptwriter or a creative person, how you can use Jung to practically structure your film or your book.
Okay, and how did this, you say this is very much a 21st century phenomenon. Were there any factors that caused this shift or this interest?
I would say it was a matter of, I'd say Campbell and Vogler became extremely popular. Then you had George Lucas, who still is a big fan of Joseph Campbell. So he started using Jung. Vogler became very influential. And I just thought it was a shame to actually let people use Jungian theory without any academic involvement. Yeah. So you have lay people, you've got writers using Jung, but no academic involvement. And what began to happen was quite a strange process. People using Jungian theory who were not academics were quite imprecise. They confused Jung and Freud and Campbell, and it became a mishmash. Vogel in particular he's not interested in being precise or academically precise or the details. He wants the overall picture. I thought it's a shame we have to get involved somehow. We just can't, you know, keep the academic school separately from the practical school. It doesn't work like this. And Luke Cockley is also a therapist, so he uses Jungian film studies in his, you know, in his own private practice. He recommends films to his patients, for instance. And as far as I know, quite a few therapists do this as well, not just film therapists, but also as part of their practice.
Okay. Well, just for the uninitiated listener, Helena, could you maybe give us a bit of an overview of what Jungian film studies is and what it can offer?
It can offer many, many things. First of all, I am particularly interested in the practical applications of Jungian film studies. And therapists are also interested in the practical applications of Jungian film studies. Unlike, I would say, Lacanian and Freudian theory, which is extremely complex and theoretical, Jung is much more user-friendly. It takes me maybe a couple of lectures to introduce students to Jung who have never read a book by Jung or know nothing about Jungian theory. So I am interested in how I can use Jung to teach people to write or to draw, to use Jung for creativity, for the purposes of creating something. Therapists are interested in Jungian film studies, particularly because they can use films as a mirror for their clients to learn about themselves. Kind of it's a self-development, self-discovery process, because films are fantastic mirrors that can initiate this self-healing and self-understanding process. And there are many, many uses for Jungian film theory. I'd say self-development and writing and painting are the main uses.
Smashing. Oh, well, maybe we can unpack that a little bit further as we go along. But what would you say are its main areas of concern?
All the main areas of concern. The first one is we've had many years of Lacanian film theory and Freudian, post-Freudian film theory, which, as I have mentioned already, is extremely complex. You have the linguistic and the imaginary, etc., etc., and the social order and the name of the father. And it is very theoretical, but if you take this theory, you cannot write out of it. You cannot really write a film using this extremely heavy body of theory. And film is a very visual thing. And it's all about images, visual images, not maybe using them as signs, but using them as symbols which can be amplified. And Lacanian and Freudian theory is very word-orientated. It's all about analyzing everything, explaining everything away in many ways. So I would say our first concern is to take film theory, the academic film theory, away from Lacan and from Freud, and to actually somehow move it towards its practical, direct practical application. Because if you think about it, the individuation theory, it's all about the narrative. It's all about how we see ourselves as a story, as the protagonist of the story, and films and books are about the same, more or less. So this is our first concern, I would say.
Sure. What would you say are the pitfalls that to avoid with Jungian film studies?
It's the age-old sign versus symbol process. So signs are interpreted literally. So you have a cave and you see it as a vagina, for instance. which cannot in Jungian, in the Jungian world, you can't do this. You have, it's a symbol, you have to have respect for this symbol, because that's the language in which the unconscious speaks, and the unconscious doesn't mean you to interpret these symbols literally. It has to, you have to have respect for them. You have to give it a range of interpretations, a range of different visions. It can be this or that or something else, or maybe it's nothing at this stage. It doesn't mean anything. You have to kind of think about it as a whole range of experiences and symbols rather than just one meaning. It's many, many different meanings.
So would you say that Jungian film studies has a more provisional, synthetic sensibility to it than the Lacanian or Freudian?
It is. I would say it has more respect for the symbol, much more respect for the symbol. The film doesn't mean just, it doesn't have just one interpretation. It has, or has the potential to have, many different interpretations, because we're all unique individuals. And that's where the phenomenological wing of the Jungian film studies steps in, because meaning is extremely subjective. Meaning is personal. It is created for you individually. If you see a symbol in the film, it doesn't mean just this. You can't say that this is a trickster and nothing else. This is, that may not be a trickster, or maybe a hero or something else. And in fact, if you think about Jungian archetypes, they're never precise. They can mix and match, and they can mingle, and there are quite a few kind of cross-pollination and intersections, and that they don't have much clarity in them. In fact, those Lacanians who are in the field of film studies, that's what they don't like about Jungian theory so far. It's not precise.
So you're saying that there's this recognition that any meaningful symbol, whether it be in film or poetry or whatever, is inevitably an interaction between the participant, the person who's engaging with it, and the symbol itself.
Absolutely. So this is your personal narrative. You see this generalized, very loose narrative on screen, but what it means, it only means it for you. It doesn't mean the same for the whole audience.
Sure. Just back to the book then for a minute or two. How did you actually go about structuring the book, and what was your rationale behind that?
We wrote separately, myself and my co-writer, Professor Luke Hockley from the University of Bedfordshire. I covered 3 or 4 chapters. He covered the rest of the chapters as well. So he mainly dealt with his idea of the third image, of the meaning-making processes behind the watching of the film, the process of film watching as well. And I mainly dealt with the structural elements, the archetypes, how they work in narratives, the individuation process, how it works in narratives. But I also, and that's quite important, I also covered the feminist vision of Jungian film studies. And out of the chapter, I wrote a separate chapter on feminism and Jungian film studies, in which obviously I criticized Jung and some of his disciples for being quite sexist and quite limited in their view of the individuating female, which coincides with the filmmaking tradition of the time. The female is not the quester, the female is not the hero, the female is the one who's waiting for the male hero at home. She's the wife, she's the daughter, she's the beautiful maiden waiting to be rescued. And right now, and Vogler maybe played a big part in this process as well, right now we're seeing more and more female protagonists.
It'd be nice to explore that a bit later on in the talk when we talk about films and television serials themselves. But just back to something that maybe relate to earlier bit of when we were talking about meaning. Jung didn't shy away from the inexplicable, the irrational, and the mysterious. How much is this reflected in the in Jungian film studies?
What I'm trying to do, that's a very difficult question for me, because I'm trying to do 2 things. On the one hand, I'm trying to give the unconscious as much respect as Jung himself gave it. So the symbols are not signs. They have a number of interpretations. The language in which the unconscious speaks is never going to be precise. hence the kind of the mystical character of some of these interpretations. On the other hand, I am trying to make Jung user-friendly, and particularly I am trying to introduce Jung to Lacanians and Freudians, who are pseudo-scientific. So you have to make Jung maybe a little bit more structured, a little less less of a mystic as well. So I am trying to do these two things simultaneously, and it is not easy, I can tell you.
Try to find a middle way there, Helena.
Absolutely, it is. It's very, very difficult, really. Sometimes I have to hide certain aspects of Jung when I, for instance, go to a film conference just to make sure that people don't get put off by Jungian theory.
Well, is there any knowledge about what Jung himself saw in film? Because he appeared to place the visual above the linguistic.
It's interesting. He didn't really, I think he mentioned cinema maybe a couple of times in his writings, but he didn't write at length about film, which is surprising because he writes at length about, obviously, Joyce's Ulysses. He writes about paintings at length. He writes obsessively about, you know, writers, musicians, Goethe, etc., etc., but he doesn't write about cinema and film, which is really strange. However, in some of his collections, I think, I'm looking here at Men and His Symbols,
yeah.
His disciples do mention Charlie Chaplin, they do in relation to The Trickster, they do mention contemporary films, maybe not Jung himself, but Joseph Henderson and Marie-Louise von Franz, they do mention cinematic narratives on a regular basis, but maybe not Jung himself. However, he was interested in the creative process and in this kind of visual, symbolic side of the creative process.
Okay. We were talking earlier a little bit about meaning, and it's obviously an important aspect of Jungian film studies, exploring meaning, and perhaps a distinction between meaning and belief, and the role in arts in general, how that can play out in this regard. Now, for example, Jung famously said, "I don't believe in God, but I know him." I mean, similarly, I don't believe in Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader, but I nevertheless find their stories meaningful. Just like I don't believe in fairies, but I can find the moral value very meaningful in fairy stories. Is this something also explored in Jungian film studies?
Definitely, because in this day and age, you've got these kind of new religions. If obviously you mentioned Luke Skywalker and Star Wars, this has become a religion in many ways, particularly because Lucas was basing himself on Campbell. Campbell was basing himself on Jung as well. So you've got this religious structure and the individuation process and kind of all the difficulties on hero's path as well. So you have to, it's an interesting question. You have to deal again with the power of cinema to create beliefs on the one hand, and on the other hand with the fact that all beliefs that you see on screen, all images on symbols are your own symbols. They may not be the same for other people as well. So you have this kind of two-tier structure of your own level, your own meaning, and then more general kind of mass meaning as well.
Sure. Okay, can we have a look at some films or TV series to see how they can be interpreted from a Jungian perspective? Maybe we could start with Tim Burton, who I know that you have a particular interest in.
That was my first book. In fact, I became interested in the figure, in the archetype of the child, how Burton uses the child archetype in his films, because I realized that all of his films are about the child. And the child in his films takes different guises. Sometimes the child can be just a child, unhappy child who lost his father, or you can have a creative person, such as, for instance, Ed Wood, filmmaker in one of his films, or Edward Scissorhands, who is also a child, but already maybe a teenager. Then you have the child who is a monster. Then you have the child who is a hero, but he's still quite childish and immature in his own kind of head. Or the heroine, if you think about Alice in Wonderland, that's when for the first time employed a female protagonist, again being influenced by the changes in contemporary film and television kind of influences and changes that are happening in narratives in film and TV right now.
Does Tim Burton recognize that he's using this archetype?
Very, very vaguely. He's very Jungian in this sense. He cannot speak properly. he gesticulates a lot. He mumbles a lot. He cannot explain. He sees it. And he often, because he doesn't write his own films, he describes them or he storyboards them and he shows them to people who can write. And then they can write them up. In this sense, he's absolutely, absolutely Jungian. And Batman is this, for Burton again, is the child who grew up to be a hero because his father died. If we go back to this Jungian archetype of the child is special, the child is the future and the past. The child is special because his parents either disappeared or they died or something happened or they neglected him, something happened to them. So that's how Burton explains the hero. The hero is this special person with these special superpowers because he used to be a special child, and this specialness is there because he is a wounded person, because he's got problems, issues with his parents. But this is a very kind of basic level. And he goes up to the level of modernity, and he talks about the hero of modernity who fights not just with the evil Joker, whoever, enemies who killed his parents, but also with ecological issues, also with this urban alienation, the psychological fragmentation, all the issues that concern the contemporary individual and post-modernity. He fights, the hero fights with them, the hero tries to overcome them on this higher level, together with other people, kind of for the sake of mankind, so to say. So he's a savior in this sense.
And then just for the average viewer going in to see one of these films, having a certain knowledge of how these things pan out from a Jungian perspective, how can that be helpful for just the person in the cinema interpreting the film?
It can be useful in several ways, as it is usually with film. On the personal way, you can relate to the film, you can use the film for kind of projective, introjective exchange as a mirror of your own personal issues, and that's what is being used in therapy. On higher levels, you can use the film to analyze the problems in your society or see the problems in your society, because Jungian, far from what Freudians and Lacanians think, Jungian film studies and Jungian theory in general does concern the issues of modernity. It does concern ecology, it does concern politics, it does concern social issues. It's not just a simplistic fairy tale structure. And that's what Burton's films show to a large extent. They look like fairy tales. Yeah. But what they discuss is the brokenness of contemporary life and how alienated we feel when we're separated from each other in this angular architecture of contemporary cities, for instance. We're not together. There's no community as such left. We are broken inside because we don't relate to other people. That's what he discusses in his films.
Interesting. Okay, and another archetype that you've explored in great detail in several of your books is the trickster. Can you think of a couple of examples maybe that illustrate that?
The best example is probably Jim Carrey's The Mask. You have this kind of green faced creature who is contemporary insane, and you have a very boring man who works in a bank. He's got a very boring life. No one likes him. He is in love with a beautiful lady, but obviously she's too posh and too beautiful to be with him. And he doesn't know how to escape from his boring life and escape himself in this sense. And then he finds this mask, and the green creature jumps out of the mask and turns him into someone that he didn't know was in him into something else and someone else, and he takes on a gang of gangsters and mafiosi people, and then he, by the end of the film, he's a changed person. He gets the beautiful woman, and the mask leaves him. The trickster goes away, because the task of the trickster was to transform the individual. And throughout the film, the individual is being transformed via this mess, via this chaos, via being out of control completely and utterly. And by the end of the narrative, the trickster leaves the narrative and leaves the protagonist, and the protagonist kind of pulls himself together and becomes a different person.
It's fascinating. And then you also talk about the process of individuation. Could you think of a couple of examples that really highlight that in film?
We can discuss it using the trickster archetype again. Okay. So it works on so many different levels. It does work on the personal level. In all these trickster films, if you think about the lighter versions, it's obviously Jim Carrey. He does play tricksters on a regular basis. If you think about the darker, more shadowy versions of the trickster, it's Jack Nicholson, a Joker type of tricksters. Kind of on the scale from the lighter tricksters to the darker tricksters, they are the two extremes. And yeah, obviously there will be lots of shades in between as well. The trickster is a big part of the individuation process in narratives, because all trickster films follow the same kind of trajectory. You have the protagonist being stuck, the protagonist not knowing where to go. Then 5 minutes into the film, the trickster arrives, turns the protagonist's life upside down. The protagonist is in a liminal state, being out of control, going through this almost ritualistic process throughout the film. And at the end of the film, the trickster has to disappear, die, or they don't really die. You know, usually they dissolved somehow, or they promise to come back whenever the protagonist is in trouble again, or the protagonist needs more chaos in his or her life. And then they, having destroyed the system being either the protagonist's own mindset, or the oppressed people around the protagonist, or the workplace, or any of the government, or any other system that stops the individual from individuating and becoming himself or herself, then the trickster can disappear. So the trickster is this trigger in the individuation process, this dynamic element that arrives every time the protagonist is stuck on the individuation path. And you can interpret the same on a high level again. Why is the trickster film so popular now? Why do we have so many comedies with tricksters? It's because the contemporary individual is in many, we're free people in the West, we've got freedom, but it doesn't mean that we're free from systemic influence, we're free from systems. There are many different systems that restrain us and control us and stop us from becoming ourselves in many ways. And we feel it. So we dream all this, we dream them up. We watch these comedies in which systems are challenged or changed or destroyed because we recognize ourselves in this protagonist.
Okay. And let's just move on now to that chapter on feminism. There were some very interesting films like Kill Bill, and also some examples of the Nordic noir like The Killing and The Bridge.
And I also mentioned Orange is the New Black, which is the new Netflix. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. And Netflix is particularly interesting because it's not your Hollywood kind of mega structure, which is very slow to accept change. Hollywood is very, very conservative in this sense. Male protagonists work, so they keep kind of producing male protagonists. Female protagonists, they're not so sure, but it's a gradually, if you think about Ghostbusters, for instance, gradually the change really trickles into Hollywood as well. We are also, myself and my colleague Katrina Miller from GCU, who's a few offices away. We're writing a book about the female protagonist now, again for Routledge, co-writing it, in which we trace how the female protagonists changed from throughout the history of the cinema. There were very, very few of them throughout the history of the cinema. and they emerged maybe in the past 20 to 30 years, and this emergence was very, very gradual. Very, if you think about Thelma and Louise, for instance. So, and the first female protagonists were more or less victims trying to break out of this oppressive world in which they were kind of placed and expected to be a certain person, expected to conform to certain roles, for instance. In the past couple of years, we've got lots of female fighters, females expressing aggression and not being punished for it. If you think about Orange is the New Black, it's absolutely shocking in this sense. Women in Orange is the New Black do things that women, female protagonists or characters have never done on television. They're being disgusting, cruel, they're murderous. And at the same time, they're still human beings. They're not objectified.
Yeah.
So this is, or Jessica Jones, who again is another protagonist from the Netflix series. She's a comic book character and she's fine with being single, with being sexually aggressive and with being not nice to men as well.
Yeah. Have you seen this latest series on BBC, Fleabag?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That I was thinking about Fleabag as well in this sense. She's allowed to be obsessed with sex and disgusting woman.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice to see this complexity starting to come out rather than just these cardboard cutouts of women you often see.
Of clean, pretty, nice-smelling women. Suddenly women can allow to be disheveled and not nice.
Or if they are the protagonist, then they sort of, they're almost default men, like I'm thinking of maybe Terminator, and it's a slow process, but maybe it's, maybe things like Orange is the New Black are really encouraging people to break new ground.
I would even think in maybe Fleabag wouldn't have been possible without Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
It's difficult to be a pioneer. You know, you'd be scared to think, what if I introduce a woman who is obsessed with sex and propositions to men on a regular basis, what would people think? Maybe they will not watch any of these series.
Very interesting. Okay, we're coming to the end now, Helena, but I always ask people this question at the end of the talk. What is your understanding of the middle way, if any, Helena, and how might that relate to Jungian film studies?
I would say it relates a lot to Jungian film studies, because even as a writer, as I've already mentioned, you have to, on the one hand, try to keep, to be true to Jungian theory, and on the other hand, to not to scare the academics, the film studies academics, for instance. So it does relate. And then in terms of teaching students, creative writing, screenwriting students, on the one hand, you have to introduce them to Jungian theory, which is quite complex, involves a lot of terminology. And on the other hand, you don't want to overcomplicate it, because they're not academics, they're actually writers. It has to be practical rather than theoretical for them. So you always have to strike some kind of balance between the two things. It's not possible to just have one way of doing things. You always have to have a balance.
Yeah. Okay, great. My last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, Helena, how would they go about it?
The best thing would be to Google, and I have my own personal page with all the books and all the information about my projects. And my email is there as well, my email address. So if someone wants to get in touch, you're most welcome. It's a public email.
Okay. Well, I'll put that up on the YouTube slideshow, and I'll also link it on the page that when I publish this. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Helena. It's been really interesting.
Thank you for having me on the program.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.